I want to encourage you tonight to turn to the book of Judges. Judges, as many of you know, is the source of the book of Judges, is the source of so many of the Old Testament stories that we grew up hearing as children. And I know that the youngest of children have heard the stories of Gideon and Samson many times over. And that is a problem, or it can be a problem. You see, sometimes because we're so familiar with this book and the stories that we find in this book, we miss the message that the book is trying to share, that God is trying to share with us through the things that we read within it. If we aren't careful, these, quote, Bible stories can become just that, Bible stories. Right up there, or maybe right down there, I should say, next to the Mother Goose fairy tales. And so it is that what we find is they no longer become powerful stories that God means to change our lives and to call us to be faithful before Him, but they become stories, just something that we go through life telling to other people, telling to our children, the stories about how Samson defeated so many and how strong he was, or what God did through Gideon with just 300 men, or what Deborah and Barak did to the army of Sisera when really it was God doing that. These stories in our Bible, that we're going, and we won't have time to go through all of these stories tonight, but they're not fantasy. No, these stories are real flesh and blood. They happen to real people that lived many years ago. And they serve as a living and powerful message for us from God. It is a message that is designed to captivate our boys and our girls, but it is also a message that is designed to challenge those of us who are adults. And in this book, what we find is a demonstration of a theme. It is something that Solomon says in Proverbs, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And it's also found as a theme here. It has to do with what happens to an individual, what happens to a society when suddenly we withdraw from our lives the moral principles that God has set to put within them. In Judges chapter 17, verse 21, and then later in chapter 21 and verse 25, this statement is repeated two times, and I believe that the writer has put it there for a great emphasis enough to us and to all who would later read it. And here are the words: in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we'll see tonight what happens when people start doing what's right in their own eyes. Remember, Solomon also said that there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is the way of death. So we have to be careful in that. And we find in the experiences of the men and the women in this book promises and warnings. And we have a choice. We can choose to act upon those promises and those warnings, or we can choose to ignore them. When you open the pages of this book, the first 2.5 chapters, actually going over to chapter 3, verse 6, are given to us to help us see why Israel falls or begins its downward spiral into this moral decay. There are the causes. And I think what the writer does for us is gives us three things that brought about the decay, the moral decay in Israel. He starts, first of all, with telling us about incomplete obedience on the part of the Israelites. You see, when Joshua led the first generation into the land of promise, they conquered the land, they took possession of the land, they defeated the great armies that existed in that day and time these different kings would bring against him. However, Joshua did not drive out every single Canaanite in the land of Canaan, in the promised land. there were still small areas of resistance that had been left. And God told the people, He had told them all the way back in the days of Moses on the other side of the river in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 22, that He would not drive out all the inhabitants. And there was a reason for that. If He drove them all out, then the beast would begin to multiply before the children of Israel could multiply enough to completely control and dominate the land. And so He was going to drive them out in phases, using the people. Joshua, as you will remember, divided the land amongst the tribes, and each tribe was responsible for continuing to drive out the resistance within its own tribal territory. Yet what we find is that the power of the Canaanites remained in what we would call the lowlands, the valley, the level areas. Why? Because the Canaanites had a weapon of war that most others would fear. They were called iron chariots. And foot soldiers could not stand against iron chariots. And so it was that for a period of time, the Israelites had trouble driving out. They failed to drive out some of these inhabitants. Judges chapter 1, verses 31, 34 bring that out. But even more serious is the fact that when they did conquer these inhabitants, when they were victorious over them, they still didn't drive them out. And the book of Judges tells us why. In verse 28, it says that when Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. You see, they valued having them as slaves more than they valued doing what God had told them to do in the first place. And that would come back to haunt them. In chapter 2, I want to share with you something that God tells them. What He does here is He sends, beginning in verse 1, the angel of the Lord from Gilgal goes to Bochim, came up from Gilgal to Bochim. And here is what the writer tells us. He said, I brought you, he's speaking on behalf of God, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land which I have sworn to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And as for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed me. What is this that you have done? Therefore, I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they will become as thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. What God was saying to them is, because you didn't keep my covenant, you didn't obey what I told you to do, I'm not going to drive them out in front of you, before you anymore. I'm going to allow them to remain. They're going to become snares to you. They're going to become thorns in your side, and you're going to wish you had listened. So the first problem is that they did not completely obey, incomplete obedience. But then as a result of that incomplete obedience and the fact that they didn't drive them out, something else happened. That something else is what we would call today apostasy, because they began drifting away from what they had been taught, the covenant they had established. One of the things that we read early on in the book in chapter 2, there in verse 10, is that after Joshua and the generation that came into the promised land with him died, he tells us that there arose another generation who knew not God nor the work that He had done for Israel. The generation before, it seems, had failed to pass on the wondrous works of God. They had neglected to share with their children or their grandchildren all of the great things that God had done in bringing them into this promised land. And then as a result of that, it wasn't long before the wisdom of God began to be proven true. You see, God had told them they needed to drive out the Canaanites. And when they didn't drive out the Canaanites, something began to happen. And what we find happening is brought out in that same chapter just a few verses later. In verse 12, it says that the Israelites forsook the Lord and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them. And then in verse 13, we're told that they forsook the Lord and followed Baal and Asherah. By not getting rid of the others, the Canaanites, driving them out so that they did not have the temptation of the gods that the Canaanites worshipped, what began to happen is that they were influenced by these peoples who were still living among them, and they began to worship the very gods that these enemies of theirs, the people they had been commanded to drive out, had not, were worshiping. And so it is that they began to leave their allegiance to the true God, and they began to combine it with an allegiance to all of these other gods. Problem number two, apostasy. Then there's problem number three, intermarriage. They didn't drive them out. They began to worship their gods. But even worse, God had told them not to intermarry with any of these people. They were only to marry their own, other Israelites. They could marry from other tribes, but they were only to marry their own. And so what we find is that that intermarriage took place. And in chapter 3, if you'll notice verses 5 and 6, here's what is said. The sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters for themselves as wives and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. So it is that we find that they began to be drawn away. They hadn't completely obeyed God. Because they'd left the people in the land, they began to follow the gods that those people worshipped. And then if that wasn't bad enough, they began to marry with the peoples who were still living in the land. What happened is that not only did they deny their identity as a distinct people of God, they were further motivated to serve those pagan gods. You see, the law that Moses had given them set forth a distinctive lifestyle that they were to live by. That distinctive lifestyle was one that was intended, as they lived it out among all of those that would be around them, to reveal the very character of God. And it was also to set them apart from all the other people. But they abandoned that lifestyle in favor of an immoral lifestyle. And it was the immoral lifestyle of the peoples of the land in which they lived. The end was that Israel denied its heritage. She denied her identity. And ultimately, she denied her God. Which brings us to what we find in the middle part of the book. Because of that, there's a pattern that begins to take place. And seven times this cycle or this pattern is repeated. We find it is identified twice in chapter 3. Once in chapter 4, again in chapter 6, chapter 8, chapter 10, and chapter 13. And each time, there is the statement that Israel sinned against the Lord their God. They turned away from following Him. So you have this cycle that begins. It starts out with the sin. And as a result of the sin, they're turning away from God. God does something. He brings judgment through the nearby nations, these other peoples around them, the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, they would come and they would attack them and they would subject those people in that area. It wasn't the entire nation, it was just different parts of it. They would subject them to servitude. So you had sin, and as a result of the sin, there was the judgment that God brought upon them, the servitude that they entered into. Well, when the pressure from the servitude became unbearable for them, they would begin to cry out to God and seek God's forgiveness and cry out for deliverance. There was the supplication. Praying to God, asking God, please deliver us from these people. Deliver us from this oppression that we're under. God would hear their prayer and God would respond. And as a result, He would send them some charismatic leader. And that charismatic leader, first of all, would give them victory over the enemy. And then throughout the rest of his lifetime, there would be, he or she, because one of them is Deborah, would serve morally and spiritually as a leader for them. And the interesting thing is that during the rest of that individual's lifetime, that judge's life, there would be peace in the land. There would be a quiet and a freedom as long as that judge lived. So we had silence. But it wouldn't be long before they would forget. And they would go right back in. They would start sinning again. And so that cycle would repeat itself. From chapter 3 through chapter 16, that cycle repeats itself 7 times. Altogether, they went through this cycle for a period of a little over 300 years. You would think after a period of time, people would learn, right? They would start to decide, we need to learn from our past. We need to learn from our mistakes. We need not to repeat these. But they didn't do that. And so what God did is God sent 12 different judges into Israel, or used 12 different individuals, which I've listed for you here. We find that their names starting in chapter 3 and going all the way through chapter 16. There's Othniel in chapter 3, and then Ehud in chapter 3. And then in chapter 3, there's Shamgar. Only one verse about him. And Deborah, chapters 4 and 5. Gideon in chapters 6 through 8. Tola in chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. Jephthah in chapter 10, going through chapter 12. Ibsen in chapter 12, verses 8 and 10. Elon, chapter 12, verses 11 and 12. Abdon in chapter 12, verses 13 through 15. And then finally, Samson in chapters 13 through 16. Now, we don't have time to go through all of the different stories that we find about each of these judges, but I want to draw your attention to the last 5 chapters of the book, because those 5 chapters give us a picture of what is taking place through this entire period of time. And they help us better learn in our own lives today what happens when we become a morally bankrupt people. When we no longer are pursuing the righteousness that God wants us to pursue, but we begin doing what seems right in our own eyes. So it is in the last 5 chapters, chapter 17 through chapter 21, we are given 3 situations, 3 different stories, if you will, that let us see just how far this nation of people had sunk in their lives and in their moral depravity. The first one is found in chapter 17 and 18. It is what we're going to call a lost legacy. The individual is a man by the name of Micah. He is from the tribe of Ephraim. Micah steals his mother's silver, 1,100 pieces of silver to be exact. His mother pronounces a curse on the thief. She doesn't know it's her son, but she pronounces a curse upon the thief. And Micah, hearing that the curse has been placed upon the individual who's stolen her silver, he is moved by fear, and he goes to his mother and he confesses that he's the one that has taken the silver. Mom, glad to get her silver back, blesses him in return, canceling out the curse. And then guess what they do with the silver? They take the silver and they dedicate it to God for idols. And they take and they make idols out of the silver, and they put it in the house, in their own household shrine, so that they have a place to go and worship there in the household shrine. What this one little section presents us with are several things that let us see the moral degradation that this nation has sunken into. And by the way, these 5 chapters aren't placed at the end of the book simply because it's the last thing that happens. Before we entered the book of 1 Samuel, we began to read about Samuel and Eli. They probably are just placed there to let us see why this has been going on. Most likely, these things took place at some other point in time. But they let us see how far the people had gone in their morals. That's not the end of this. You see, Micah goes on to pronounce his son a priest. And that is contrary to the law. You see, the law required that a priest came out of the tribe of Levi. This young man, his son, is not from Levi. He's from Ephraim. But then on top of that, one day there's a young Levite coming through town, and Micah encounters him, and Micah basically says to him, listen, I want to hire you. I want you to be my father and my priest. Well, he's not out of the tribe. He's not of Aaron's lineage. But that doesn't matter. He's a Levite. I'm going to make him my priest. He becomes a priest in the household of Micah, And he officiates over the shrine that Micah has set up with the household idols. If that isn't bad enough, we find that Micah is thrilled at the turn of events. In Micah's mind, this is a good thing, because what Micah says in Judges chapter 17, verse 13 is this: "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite priest." He's forgotten that the law says all the priests come out of Aaron, out of the descendants of Aaron. He seems to have ignored that part of the law. And in his mind, God is going to bless him because he's doing what in his mind seems right. Think about it, folks. Aren't there people today doing the same thing? Don't we have people around us that are taking this right here and twisting it to say what they want it to say, and becoming so confused in their thinking that they all actually believe that God will bless them for sinful habits, sinful lifestyles, and sinful worship? That's what's happened back then. As Solomon would write in Ecclesiastes, "Nothing new under the sun. What has been will be." It hasn't changed. It was that way before, it's that way again. But that isn't the end of our story. One evening, 600 Danites come through town. They are the tribe of Dan. They have learned about this young Levite. And guess what they do? They say, "We want to make you a proposition. You come with us, we'll take care of you." They give him a promotion. "We'll pay you better than he's paying you." Know what he does? He willingly, gladly goes with them, steals the shrine, the various idols that Micah has in his shrine, takes them with him as he goes with these Danites, because they're going to conquer a town that belongs to the Sidonians to drive them out. Micah learns of it, goes after them, tells them it's not right. They've taken his priest and they've taken his idols, and they tell him, "You have a choice. You can stay here and fuss about it, and we'll take your life, or you can turn around and go back home." Micah turns around and dejectedly goes back home. The end of the story is that the young Levite goes on to serve as priest for the rest of his life in the town where these Danites eventually settle, and his descendants also as well. And guess what? He serves in a shrine which they set up with the idols that he's taken from Micah's house. And the book doesn't condemn it. It just tells you this is how bad things have gotten. Our second story takes place in chapter 19. It begins in chapter 19. It is the story about a Levite who has a concubine. And this concubine becomes angry with him, and she leaves him because of a spat, and she goes back to her father's house. 4 months go by, and the Levite decides he's going to go try to convince her to come back with him. So he goes to where she's staying at her father's. He sits down. He convinces her that she needs to come back. And this is good for the father, because you see, in that day and time, it would have reflected badly upon his house had she not gone back with this man. And secondly, if there had been a bride price that had been paid to him for her, he was going to have to return the money if she had refused to go back home. The father convinces the Levite to stay for an extended period of time to enjoy the Eastern hospitality. 5 days later, the Levite finally says, "I'm taking her and we're going home." But they don't leave till later in the afternoon. It's about 3 p.m. and they start back. He will not. It's starting to get dark. He doesn't want to travel after dark. But they come by the city of Jebus, which is Jerusalem. It's not yet been taken by the Israelites. He doesn't want to stay there because it still is controlled by the enemies. So he goes on to a city that is in the territory of the Benjamites. It is the city of Gibeah. There, no one shows him hospitality until there's a man coming in from the fields. He is actually an Ephraimite himself, but he has a place apparently there in Gibeah. He takes him in that evening. And at night, the inhabitants of the city come and begin, the men of the city begin pounding on the door. The reason they're pounding on the door, as the text tells us, is that it is their intention to have that Levite man come out to them, and they want to make him a victim of homosexual assault. Finally, the pounding on the door becomes so great that he's afraid they're going to beat the door down and do harm to everybody in the house, so he takes his concubine and he pushes her out the door to them. They basically rape her that night. She crawls back to the door, and the next morning as he gets up and he opens the door to go on his way, there she is. Her hand is on the door. She's lying in the threshold. He kicks her to get her to wake up, and she doesn't move. She's dead. That's chapter 19. Chapters 20 and 21 finish the story for us. He takes her, puts her on his donkey, takes her back home. When he gets home, he cuts her up into 12 pieces. He sends each one of the 12 pieces to each of the 12 tribes. And he calls them to come to him. The tribes are so shocked that something like this has happened in Israel that they come to see why a man would do this to a woman. He begins to tell them the story. Of course, he conveniently leaves out the fact of what he had done and the cowardly way in which he had responded. And when they hear this, they're angry with the people of Benjamin, specifically Gibeah. They go to the Benjamites and they tell the Benjamites to send out the various people that are responsible for this atrocious act there in Gibeah. And yet Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, would not surrender some of their own. So a great civil war erupts. And as we come toward the end of the book, there are many thousands who have been killed, and the tribe of Benjamin is almost wiped out. So you've got that conflict that occurs within the nation of the people. Years before, when Joshua had first come into the land and the 2.5 tribes on the other side of the Jordan River had come across and helped them conquer the land, as they were going back across, they had built an altar. The purpose of the altar was to remind the tribes on the western side of the Jordan that we too are a part of Israel, because they were afraid that the day would come when they might forget. But they mistook it as an altar set up to worship God in violation of the commandment that God had given. And so they were willing to go to war because they thought this was sin, until it was explained to them the true purpose behind it. Here what we have is we have the people willing to defend sin within their own country and go to war because of the sin of a few, rather than saying this is sinful and they need to be punished, they need to be put to death. When you take the entire book, here's what you have. You have what happens when people abandon God's ways. You see, morality, folks, is never just an individual or personal thing. No, morality affects people all across the board. And it stands and holds, the strands of morality is what holds a society together. It provides security for the members of that society, but it's only so when they are rooted in a proper morality. When we abandon God's standards, what we begin to do is we sear our conscience and we confuse our ability to distinguish between good and evil. And that's why Solomon would write, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but that way is a way of illusion." Because when the hard reality of life sets in, what he tells us is that that way which seems right to a man, because his conscience has become seared and he can no longer distinguish between what's good and what's evil, it leads him to the way of death. This book is a powerful book that speaks to us today in the 21st century, because we have people all around us that have a way that seems right to them. But folks, it's leading down the wrong road. And ultimately, it's going to lead them to death. The morality, if we abandon, not only as individuals, but as a society, if we abandon the basic principles of morality that God has set forth, what's going to happen? Where will we end up as a society? We wonder now why we have school shootings. We wonder now why one man will do such devastating things to another human being. Are we really at a loss to understand it? I don't believe God's people are. I think those who are God's people can see the reason we're struggling as a country, the reason we're struggling as a society now, is because we have abandoned the moral principles which made us strong. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is reproached many people. And until we turn that around, until we turn it around in our own lives and in our own communities, we will not see a nation that turns around. So tonight, the question is for you. It starts with each individual. Are you functioning? Are you living by the moral principles that God has set forth in His Word? Are you honoring Him with the life that He's given you? Are you a child of God? Because that's the beginning point. If you're not a child of God, if you've never come to Christ in obedient faith, putting Him on in baptism, confessing that He is Lord and Savior, repenting of sin, then why do you wait? What are you putting it all for tonight? I ask you, won't you come as together we stand and sing?